Continuing the interview with Dr. Thin, the head of the American section of the Republic of Vietnam Foreign Office. He told me along the same line that the North Vietnamese Army had superior rifles by a 67 supplied by their allies, whereas the South Vietnamese Army got equivalent rifles from the United States only in 69 when Vietnamization began. South Vietnamese aircraft has been modernized only in 72. And putting in my own parenthesis, it's clear, of course, from our visit to the Chief of Naval Operations and to the naval cutter last week that they have received some naval capability to protect their own shores only recently. I asked Dr. Thin whether there is any opinion among leading Vietnamese, or whether there had been any, in favor of using tactical nuclear weapons. And he said no. But he did say that he believed that the South Vietnamese Army with the United States troops should have invaded the North, not to conquer, but to show that, as he put it, we meant business, to show strength. I mentioned the failure of the United States government to win the support of the people, to produce understanding of the war, of the sort which Roosevelt did so well. And he added that his government and the United States was unwilling to use the same propaganda tactics abroad and at home that the North Vietnamese and the VC have used. They refused to invent lies as North Vietnam did. My own thought is, this is all very well, but our leaders, Roosevelt and Churchill, in the Second War, produced wonderfully effective speeches, popular understanding of the war, faith in the government, and they, of course, did not invent, as the Nazis did, at all. He had an interesting view on this point. He says that Americans have been confused by the idea that North Vietnam would be or is Titoist, that is, independent of the major communist powers. And he said that perhaps it would be Titoist, but it's trying to conquer the South, and that's what matters, whether it's tied to China or Russia or both is not the main point. And, of course, this is very understandable, coming from a South Vietnamese patriot like Dr. Thin. On the question of the leopard spots in the upcoming ceasefire agreement, he doubted the sincerity of North Vietnam in committing itself to abide by the boundaries of the territory that it holds, the very spotted pieces of territory that it holds in the South. He says that it doesn't take much knowledge of communist government to realize that they don't abide by this type of commitment. And I couldn't help but agree with him. Later in our conversation, I raised some rather pointed questions. First, I asked him about the talk one hears about the indifference of the mass of South Vietnamese people. Indifference or neutralism, or as it used to be called during the French period, attentisme. He says that this was true very largely until 1968, but it has not been true since. He says the Tet Offensive taught the South Vietnamese people what the NLF is really like. Its brutal methods and so on. In my own parentheses, one of the amazing things that has been brought home to me here is that in our press, no appreciation has been shown of the enormous fact that the VC, the NLF, is defeated. It just doesn't exist as an important guerrilla or other military entity. It's the North Vietnamese Army that is being fought in the South now, no longer the VC. The VC is finished. What a remarkable neglect. Our reporters obviously are not looking for favorable news, only the other kind. I told Dr. Thin that I have read a great deal about the tyranny of the present government. He didn't deny it. On the point of elections, he declared that they weren't bad. They were fair enough, he said, compared with what happens in some countries of Southern Europe. They don't compare with elections in Sweden or Britain, he said. But he knows Europe. He's studied at the Sorbonne. He's traveled in Europe. He studied political science. And he thinks that the fairness of elections stacks up well enough with the fairness of some that happen in countries of Europe. He spoke disparagingly about stories in the American press about enormous numbers of political prisoners. And of course, I have no way of knowing how those numbers stack up. I raised the question of corruption. I have heard, for example, that a boy who is well-to-do can obtain a passport for 1,000,000 piastres, and that a boy whose papers are not in order, who should be drafted, should have been drafted, and who is stopped by the police, can pay off to the tune of 100,000 piastres. Well, Dr. Thin didn't deny that there is corruption. He said these figures are probably exaggerated. But he declared that in Vietnam, for hundreds of years, corruption has been used as a lubricant, using his word. And he said that it can't be stopped in a moment, especially under war conditions. Dr. Thin was in the North from 1944 to 1949. He tells me that the Roosevelt policy of freedom for Indochina was very well understood in the North. He stressed that Ho Chi Minh's use of nationalism as a cover for communism was very effective until 1949. Then, he tells me, Ho Chi Minh's essential Stalinist style of communism became clear as his main goal. And he stressed very heavily that, after all, Ho Chi Minh outranked Mao Zedong in the Comintern. Unlike Mao, he was a founder of the Comintern. And he was very strong on the point that he was a Stalinist, and he believes that the North Vietnamese government remains essentially Stalinist. He said that before 1949, many who were in the know understood that Ho's real purpose was Stalinist communism, not mere nationalism. Dr. Thin has a very strong face and way of speaking. I felt that he was thoroughly sincere. I was surprised by his candor on quite a few points. But then I've been surprised in that respect any number of times. People, including officials of the South Vietnamese government, do not behave like the victims, subjects of a tyranny. They speak openly. They speak freely. They speak freely to strangers. After all, they have no knowledge of what use I might make of what they say. They are not afraid. They speak critically of their government. This is very impressive. I really didn't expect it. Things were quite exciting today as we got the news that President Nixon has stopped all bombing north of the DMZ. And everyone is highly expectant, feeling that this is an indication that Kissinger in Paris has come close to a ceasefire, if he doesn't have it in hand already. The excitement over a ceasefire mingles with the excitement of the coming Tet holiday. That's February 3rd. More than 2 weeks away, but we begin to see signs of it, vaguely like the signs of Christmas coming in our part of the world. Carts loaded with almost Santa Claus-like masks for sale, and all sorts of gaudy gimcrackery are roaming the streets, and people are buying gifts for Tet.
I kept abreast of the news by talking to the Swedish journalist whose name I still haven't caught, and also with Spencer, the Esso manager, who's roaming around the country. Singapore is his base. Everyone is optimistic except Miss Lien. She tells me that I had a dinner with American members of the embassy last evening. They were all optimistic too. And when she declared her pessimism about a ceasefire, they wanted to lay wagers with her that there would indeed be a ceasefire very soon. My own thought is that although we may have a ceasefire, the details of it will be so incredibly more difficult to enforce and carry out than, for example, the North Korean armistice, which has certainly been difficult enough. It will be so difficult to take care of problems like the leopard spots that it will not be a transition from war to peace. It will be a sort of a new stage, no doubt a quieter stage, a less violent one, but not a stage of simple peace. I just can't imagine it. Into this hotel today has come a great flock of delegates to a convention on the Mekong development programs, very much like the sort of thing one might observe in an American hotel. And there's also going on an economic seminar among Vietnamese officials, American officials, and delegates of other countries who are pondering the economic problems of the country as it faces peace, or at least quasi-peace. On the streets, the PPF still stand guard at corners, at crucial spots. Apparently the office of the Council on Foreign Relations down on the first floor is such a crucial spot. And there are, of course, the pillboxes and strong points around government buildings, and the super strong points that are like massive short towers around the American Embassy. I have booked a flight by Air France to Delhi 2 weeks from today, because I'm told that the planes are getting crowded. But of course I can change that if either Elizabeth comes out, or if I find there's more to be done here. One thing that I believe I haven't mentioned is that Commander Black at MACV, who is in charge of intelligence briefing, told me that the press releases, the file of the press releases, has been sent to Washington. And he gave me the names of the people at the Pentagon who will show them to me. I carried a letter to the United States Embassy for Ambassador Bunker, and within a few hours, his secretary telephoned me saying that the ambassador will be able to see me next week. Then Miss Lien also arranged a meeting for me with Mr. Charles Cooper, in charge of the economic section of the U.S. Embassy, a particular friend of Walt's. This is Wednesday night, January 17th. I drove with Mrs. Tsung in the mini monster bus of the Council on Foreign Relations out to the largest refugee camp in the neighborhood of Saigon. It's actually about 20 miles out on the road toward Bien Ho. I've read horrendous tales about the expansion of shack towns, shack settlements around Saigon. So far as I have seen the outskirts, these tales are not true. There are slums, of course. Along one river there are extremely poor-looking shacks built out onto the river, but they're very old. And the most that may be true is that they are more crowded because of refugees than they used to be. Now, the refugee camp we went to is new. It was built to take care of people whose villages were destroyed in the North Vietnamese offensive that began last spring. The captain, army captain in charge of the camp, took us on a long, dusty tour. There are tents and sort of knocked together cabins and some concrete block buildings. They're all very dreary, and the people mostly look pretty sad. The most that you can say about them, besides their sadness, is that they're curious about a foreigner walking around like me. There were little boys flying tiny kites they had made out of scraps of paper and scraps and flew with scraps of string. They seemed quite gay and pathetic. Most of the refugees in the camp, about 15,000 people, most of them are Montagnard. The North Vietnamese Army, after all, invaded from the west and displaced the people of the mountain tribes most of all. They're darker than the Vietnamese proper. One can see the difference quite easily. Rice for the grown-ups and milk for the children seems to be about the extent of the ration. The men are busy in a languid sort of way, gathering wood for the fires between the rows of shacks, the fires with which they cook their rice. Some of the Montagnard women are weaving beautiful lengths of cloth. These they sell in Saigon in order to buy a few more things to eke out their living. The government provides their shelter and their minimum diet, such as it is. A striking thing we saw was a clinic for babies. One point about the camp organization is that families are kept together. And there are quite a few babies around. And in one little building, there's a clinic. Seated at a table, surrounded by women with their babies wanting attention, was a young man, somewhat long-haired, with a young woman who seemed to be doing most of the actual medical work. I take it very simple. Medications, shots, aspirin, whatnot. The woman or girl was blonde, and I asked Mrs. Tsung who they were. She found out that they are American civilian volunteers. I was deeply impressed by their work and their behavior. They were so busy that I didn't dare to interfere and try to talk to them. But it was obvious that they were doing very important work and working hard at it. There are rather sad little schoolhouses, roofed over, pavilions really. The captain was anxious to explain that there were no pupils in the schoolhouses because they had their classes in the morning. But it seemed odd that with all the children running around, they shouldn't keep them busy at school in the afternoon, too. There were no sports for children or anyone else that I could see, the exception of a few individualistic boys who had made those charming little kites for themselves. There was a kind of listlessness among the people. I asked what entertainment they had, and I was told that they have movies and TV every evening. I asked whether the people stayed there permanently or whether some moved. And the captain explained that there had already been 3,000 who had moved out and taken jobs. Some vocational training is provided for the adults. And literacy is achieved by some, because very few of the Montagnard are literate at all. Now, what is a person to think about a camp like this? Obviously, if it were found in the United States or Western Europe, if victims of some disaster, any war or natural disaster, were handled in this way, it would be considered a frightful disgrace. The dust, the dreariness, the poverty of the accommodations, the lack of social activism in the program of the camp. But if one thinks about the slums of Singapore and Hong Kong, how the refugees live in Hong Kong, those who have escaped from Red China, enormous numbers of them. In other words, if one thinks of this camp, not in comparison with Western standards, But in comparison with local standards, Southeast Asian standards, it's not so bad. The people may be bored. The captain said that if there's a ceasefire, they will go back to their villages, that that's what they want to do. They're simply waiting, and they're doing very little but staying alive while they wait. And I suspect that a story could be made, could be written for our press that would be just as gruesome about the slums of any of the big cities in the Orient as the stories we've been hearing about the refugees. Now, the very fact that there are refugees is another matter. In immediate terms, they were pushed out of their villages by the North Vietnamese. Obviously, they didn't want to go along with the North Vietnamese army.